This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 207 was recorded on 2/20 of 2020. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices is brought to you by TopTradersUnplugged.com, a podcast dedicated to quant and rules-based investing, helping investors overcome behavioral biases. Ralph Del Judas, global macro strategist for Pavilion Global Markets, joins me as this week's feature interview guest. We're going to take a deep dive on interest rates. Ralph says they're headed lower, but his rationale for why they're headed lower is one you probably haven't heard elsewhere. Since last week's episode, we've been overwhelmed with requests for more details on the long vol component of Chris Cole's Dragon portfolio. So our own Patrick Serezna has prepared an in-depth post-game chart book to cover some of the long vol trading strategies that can be put on using listed instruments.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Now, Eric, before we even get to the equities, I'd love an update from you on what's going on with this coronavirus story.
Well, Patrick, I am pleased to announce that the coronavirus situation has been contained to subprime. And obviously, I say that facetiously, but you know, when Ben Bernanke said that, most people believed him. It was only a relatively small number of really smart people who understood the mechanisms for credit contagion to be transmitted. And frankly, I see a very strong parallel here. The narrative at the time that Bernanke used is, well, look, there's never been a across-the-board sell-off in housing prices before. We got nothing to worry about. The corollary today is markets are rallying, particularly commodity markets, crude oil up more than 10% off its lows now. On the worst is over in China. That's the narrative. There's little evidence, meanwhile, of community spreading outside of China, with the sole exception of the Diamond Princess cruise ship, which obviously is an anomaly just because it's a cruise ship and people are all in tight quarters together. In my opinion, that narrative, which is, I'm absolutely convinced, what's driving markets higher, along with the expectation, which I agree with, that this will ultimately lead to much more central bank stimulus. Patrick, there are three principal reasons that I very strongly disagree with that narrative, which is driving markets higher. Number one, China is massaging their data, trying to make the situation in China look better than it is. They changed the rules again in the last week on confirmation criteria. So now, where they had added that whole bunch of cases last week because they changed the rules to say when we diagnose someone without using the PCR test, using a CAT scan or something, obviously they should be counted too. Market didn't like that. So even though that change made sense last week, they decided to reverse it and take those cases back out of the count again. So China's obviously massaging the data, trying to make the situation sound better than it is. First rule of governments and markets is you almost ignore what they say and you instead pay very close attention to what they actually do. They're locking things down even tighter in Wuhan. People not allowed to leave their homes. The situation is anything but under control in China, but it's being made to look like it's better than it is. Number two, the reason that there's very little evidence, which is true, of community spreading outside of China is very simple, Patrick, because they're not testing for it. And furthermore, with asymptomatic transmission, which we discussed with Dr. Chris Martinson a couple of weeks ago, it means that people don't get sick when they're spreading the virus. So it's being spread all around. And a lot of the people doing the spreading and a lot of people being infected have no idea that they are infected. Number three, the perception that the Diamond Princess cruise ship is an anomaly. It doesn't count because it's a cruise ship. Look, the Diamond Princess is the one place where we have exhaustive testing, where they're testing everybody. And look at the results of that testing. There's no place else where everybody is being tested. So people are dismissing it as an anomaly. In reality, what the Diamond Princess is it's exactly representative. It's like a lab experiment where we can see what the real impacts of this virus are. And needless to say, it's incredibly contagious. Now, yes, the Diamond Princess is a cruise ship. People are packed in tightly, close together, more so than they would be in rural Montana. But it's perfectly representative of something like a long-haul airline flight. So packing people full of airplanes in Asia, flying them all over the world without doing any testing, without knowing whether or not they're contagious and spreading the virus. It's no surprise, Patrick, that there is no evidence of community spreading when you don't test for it. Now, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control have announced that they're planning to do exactly what they should be doing. I really want to applaud them. They said, look, we're going to start testing in 5 cities. Any flu tests that get processed, if it's negative for the flu, we're going to test it for COVID-19. That kind of broad-based testing where they put the feelers out and see whether or not community transmission is occurring in the United States is exactly what healthcare authorities across the entire world should be doing. But Patrick, they've made this announcement. As far as I understand, it hasn't actually started yet. I tried to get the exact count, and the best number I could get is unfortunately over a week old. As of February 12th, what do you think the grand total number of tests that have occurred in the United States was as of February 12th, admittedly just over a week ago? 361 people, grand total, had been tested for coronavirus in the United States. We're not yet geared up to do the testing. Now, CDC is doing exactly what they should be doing, but those tests are not in place yet. That's the reason that we're not hearing about high case counts outside of China. I want to share a story from one of our listeners because it's a really important story, I think. This gentleman, a guy that I met in Vancouver at our Macro Voices Live event, super guy, wrote me and he said, Eric, my kid's in an international school in Europe, one of these prominent private schools that a lot of people send their kids to when they're living overseas. Kid shows up from Hong Kong. Wealthy family apparently said, okay, coronavirus, we're scared of coronavirus. We want our kid out of Hong Kong. Send him to an international school in Switzerland. Hong Kong kid shows up. Hong Kong kid gets sick. Other kids get sick. Our listener's daughter gets sick. They go to the hospital, tell them the story. Guy comes from Hong Kong. He's running from coronavirus. He left Hong Kong to hopefully not get the coronavirus. Shortly after arriving, he gets sick, gets our daughter sick. We're scared. What should we do? I say, oh, put a mask on because we don't know what else to do. He said he really had the impression that they had never really thought about this. They thought about it for a while. And they said, well, look, the coronavirus testing, we're not set up to do that here. And it's kind of an elaborate process. And there's no good way to do that. And, you know, it's been 14 days since this kid arrived. So, you know, it's probably just the flu. Just go home, go about your life, and don't worry about it. Well, first of all, the whole idea behind the 14 days as a quarantine period is if you don't get sick in the 14 days, that means you didn't get affected. These kids did get sick, and he also found out that the other kids in school got sick. So he calls all the other parents and says, look, this happened to my kid. Do you know about the Hong Kong kid? Your kid's sick, my kid's sick. What should we do? None of the other parents had any interest in having their kids tested because they feared the possibility of a quarantine. So that's the way people, including hospitals, are behaving. Now, that's just one case, Patrick. And, you know, I really don't fault the people in the hospital. They don't have COVID-19 test kits, apparently, at this hospital in Switzerland. They're doing the best they can. They think it's probably just a seasonal flu. But how do we know, considering that for younger people particularly, what's known about this disease is that a lot of young people, they get it. It feels just like the seasonal flu. They don't get any worse symptoms than that, but they spread it to other people. And it's particularly older people over 50 who develop the really, really serious symptoms. How do we know, Patrick, that kid from Hong Kong didn't bring COVID-19? This group of school kids all got it. They went through actually COVID-19. It felt like the seasonal flu, and they gave it to their parents, and it's spreading wildly in that community, and we just don't know it yet. You can't know it if you don't test for it, and they're not testing for it even when this very responsible gentleman took his kid to the hospital and said, I want them tested for it because there's this connection to Hong Kong. We're very concerned. That's one story. I don't know how much other things like that are going on around the world, Patrick. The point is, they're not really testing. So the perception of the market is we don't really have a problem outside of China because there hasn't been that high of a case count. Well, first of all, the reality there is the case count outside of China is growing exponentially. The doubling time for the case count outside of China is about 7 days. If you say that to most market participants, they'll say, wait a minute, that includes Diamond Princess. That's an anomaly. You got to exclude the cruise ship because that's an anomaly. It doesn't count. First of all, it does count. But even if you exclude it, Patrick, the case count is still growing exponentially, even excluding Diamond Princess outside of China. It's not quite the 7 day doubling period when you include the Diamond Princess cases, but it's still growing exponentially. And that's without doing very much testing. What if we were doing testing? Another thing you'll hear very frequently is, look, we don't have a single case in South America. This thing's just not a problem. Okay, how many tests have been done in South America? Any? I don't know the answer. If somebody told me, look, we've done 150,000 tests in South America and nobody seems to have it, I'd say, okay, that's really a sign of relief. That's not the story here. Meanwhile, we've got two breaking stories just in the last 24 hours, maybe the next two Wuhans. There's a city in South Korea called Daegu. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong. City of about 2.5 million people. They went just in a couple of days from zero to more than 100 cases. Interestingly, the woman who is believed to be the super spreader who spread most of the cases got sick around February 10th, was asked to take a coronavirus test and refused on the grounds that she had not traveled internationally and therefore wasn't necessary, proceeded to go to church and infected everyone around her. Now they've got more than 100 cases, and apparently in this particular city, it looks like a ghost town. Everybody is scared to death today, and the streets are completely vacant. So another city in Iran, I don't know how to pronounce it, Qom, 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 I don't know. That is a city of about 1.3 million people in Iran. They went from no cases overnight to two cases and two deaths to the next day, now 25 cases and these two deaths. Now, obviously, those cases probably existed and hadn't been reported previously, but how many other places around the world is the same thing happening? Japan is asking people to focus on telecommuting as much as possible. Sounds like they might be starting to make their first moves toward a general quarantine. Now, I'm definitely not saying that the sky is falling and everybody's going to die of coronavirus. What I am saying is the market is completely mispricing risk, Patrick. There is some kind of global event coming, whether it is a full-on pandemic that really leads to a lot of deaths, or if it's just a global spreading of something more serious than a seasonal flu that has a difficult economic impact but maybe doesn't kill that many people. I don't know. There's a range of possibility there. But it seems more than 50% likely to me that some type of global event is on the near horizon. And markets are acting as if everything in China is contained, the worst is over, and there's no problem anyplace else. We're not doing the testing to adequately come to the conclusion that we don't have a community spreading problem outside of China. But because there is an absence of conclusive data saying there is a problem, everybody seems to want to just assume that there's not a problem. We don't have enough data. We don't know the answer yet, but we shouldn't be making the assumptions that we're making. Consider this, Patrick. The impetus, at least from what I see online, as to why suddenly there was this panic sell-off of 50 S&P points during the course of the day today on Thursday, was apparently the trigger was a report saying that Apple iPhone sales could be down as much as 50% Q1 2020 as opposed to Q1 2019 because of the situation in China. Oh my gosh, Patrick, Apple's not going to sell as many iPhones. My heart bleeds for them. That causes the market to panic 50 points. What's going to happen when people figure out that it is entirely plausible that global GDP could be down 25% in 2020 compared to 2019. That is absolutely not a prediction. I don't know that that's going to happen. I don't necessarily even think that's likely to happen. I don't know where this virus is headed. Neither does anybody else. And they're all acting as if there's no risk, when in reality, we just don't know where it's headed. But what evidence we do have tells us that we should be a lot more concerned than I think people are. And listeners, Patrick and I were just joking in a little edit break we just took. I'm going on 15 minutes about the virus. Maybe I need to do a separate podcast just about the virus. Maybe this weekend, if I can make time, I'll look at putting one together. Needless to say, I think the market is not adequately pricing the risk here. Let's keep it rolling, Patrick.
All right. Well, let's get on to the S&P 500. You were mentioning the 50-point volatile swing in there. But really, what I'm seeing here is that the S&P is pinned into the option expiration roll, where there's huge open interest between the 3350 to 3400 strikes. And it'll be interesting to see next week whether or not, once all of that rolls off, whether we start seeing considerable volatility come in next week. Anyway, what are you watching on the markets?
You know, I agree with you that what's probably driving the market, as it always does, into options expiration is that pinning function around whatever the hottest OPEX strikes are going to be. I haven't even paid attention to it. I've been very focused, as our listeners I'm sure can tell, on this virus story. What I think about is longer term is, okay, you got Janet Yellen coming out in the last week saying in the next downturn we should buy stocks. It's very clear that they see something's on the horizon. You would think that if the situation is much worse than we think with respect to the virus, it's a big down event in the stock market. Well, you know, if the guys with the printing press say they're going to respond to any bad news by buying stocks, I suppose anything is possible. So I closed my S&P puts because I think if you're betting that something bad happens out of this coronavirus story to the global economy, it makes more sense to play that in bonds and commodities. And I know crude oil best, so that's where I'm doing most of my trading.
All right, Eric, let's talk the dollar index, because the U.S. dollar is just ripping at this moment. Particularly, we saw huge breaks in the Japanese yen, as well as the pound sterling, the Aussie dollar. Everything's starting to move. The euro was obviously the big one moving the other week. What's your take on the dollar here?
I think the weakness in the yen is coming from the situation in Japan, where it looks like they could be affected too by this coronavirus situation. And I think that since most of the market is not really taking the coronavirus as seriously as I am, I think the upside that I see coming for the dollar out of the virus situation hasn't even hit the tape yet. So this is other stuff that's driving it. I think we're headed much higher on the dollar as the story breaks, if it breaks, if I turn out to be right about the coronavirus.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil, because we're definitely getting a bit of a bounce here in the last week. How far do you think this can go?
Well, you remember last week I said, although I thought fair value was much lower, I expected the market to bounce by $5. And that's pretty much exactly what we got. We got $5 for sure off of the lows. I don't know if we got $5 above the level we were at when we recorded last week's show. Is it done here? I don't know. I kind of was thinking that somewhere around the 34 to 100-day moving average was my target for where this bounce would take us. And I thought that it would roll over very quickly and we'd move to new lower lows below $50. That's still my outlook. The question is the top really in after today? On one hand, today's action, if I just look at the tape action, really looks like a reversal candle. If I look at just the way the market reacted, first inventory took the market up, but then it just retraced so quickly out and kept moving down. Feels like maybe this is over, but I was expecting to hit the 100-day moving average at 55.74 before it was over. So maybe one more push, but I don't think we're going back to 60. I mean, I suppose anything's possible. There's technical repair lines all the way up to 60 spot 72 on the TPO chart. I'll be very surprised if we get there, but it's going to depend on news flow. We need to see what happens and how the rest of the world reacts as some of these situations unfold outside of China.
How did the inventory numbers come in, Eric?
Crude oil building 414,000 barrels, smaller build than had been anticipated by API the night before. Cushing, Oklahoma, drawing down a relatively small 133,000 barrels. Gasoline, the big drawdown, 2 million barrels. Distillates drawing down 636,000 barrels. Meanwhile, we're back to 13 million barrels of U.S. production. That is a record high level, though it was set a good 6 or 7, maybe even more weeks ago than that. And we've been holding right at that level, Patrick.
All right, well, let's talk gold, because gold breaks to a fresh 52-week high, but it's not just a fresh 52-week high. We haven't been this high since 2013 on the price of bullion. What's your thinking here? Are we going much higher still?
Oh, ultimately, I think we're going a lot higher. And also, let's remember, in dollar terms, it's only since 2013. We are at a all-time, you know, in all of history, high on gold in a lot of currencies, including the euro. So I definitely think that, you know, gold's going to several $1,000s per ounce before this decade is out. I sound like John Kennedy. Before this decade is out, this nation should commit itself to printing enough money to drive the price of gold to the moon. And no, it's not going to return it back safely to the earth. It's going to stay up there. Unfortunately, that has a lot more to do with the value of the dollars going down than the value of the gold going up. I definitely think much higher. The thing is, Patrick, we're now at a new cycle high. We took out the previous high. It's super duper bullish in the long term, but it continues to add to my concern that this market has moved so much so fast that it makes it more susceptible to a really violent pullback. Now, what happens if I'm right and there really is a major global economic dislocation as a result of the coronavirus? Should be good for gold. Bad stuff happening in the world usually is good for gold. But there's also the old saying that all correlations go to one in a panic, and people sell everything to raise cash. Frankly, if there was a panic and people were selling gold because of an economic dislocation arising from the coronavirus, I would say that's a fantastic buying opportunity, and I would be very eager to buy more gold. But remember, if we just keep going up from here, it is a setup for there to be a lot of vulnerability to some really brutal pullbacks. So just be ready for that.
All right, Eric, let's move on to that 10-year treasury yield. I mean, we're trading right along the 2019 lows, right around the 1.50 level. Do you think we're going much lower from here?
Well, Patrick, the crazy thing is I was putting my notes together for the recording session that we're doing right now, just a little over an hour and a half ago, and I wrote down 1.57, 1.57 was the 10-year yield. It's like an hour and a half later, and we're down to 1.52. Needless to say, it's dropping fast. I think it's got a lot lower to go. If I'm right about the coronavirus situation causing some kind of major global economic dislocation. I don't know it's going to kill a lot of people, but I'm convinced it is going to have economic impacts globally way beyond what most people are estimating. Then we're headed to new lows below the 1.34, whatever the number was from 2016. We're going lower. I wish we could get some kind of pullback here up to 170 or so as a buying opportunity, but I think it's ultimately headed much lower.
All right. Well, this week's featured interview guest is Ralph Del Judas. Why did we invite Ralph onto the show?
Well, I got to credit you, Patrick. I had never heard of Ralph before. You found him. He's a super smart guy. He's got a lot of terrific insights. And I think it's a perspective. A lot of our guests have felt that we're headed toward lower treasury yields. Ralph has a different, bigger picture, longer term view that I found very enlightening. I thought it was an excellent interview, and I think our listeners are really going to enjoy it as well. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. In the past, the founder and host, Niels Kastrup Larsen, has provided Macro Voices listeners with some really good resources. But I think you'll agree with me that this time, he's really outdone himself with a brand new third edition to his Ultimate Guide to Systematic Trading Books. Now, this latest edition isn't limited to just quant trading books. It's actually a comprehensive guide to many of the best investing books ever written. And right now, Macro Voices listeners can get a free copy of this excellent guide to all the best investing books by going to toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. And if you haven't heard it yet, be sure to listen to my full-length interview with Niels Kastrup Larsen on trend following. The download link is in your research roundup email. Check out toptradersunplugged.com today. You'll be glad you did.
Eric's interview with Ralph is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Ralph Deljudis, global macro strategist for Pavilion Global Markets. Ralph put together a terrific slide deck for today's interview. You'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, that means you're not yet registered at macrovoices.com. In that case, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com. Look for the red button that says Looking for the Download right next to Ralph's picture on our homepage. Ralph, it's great to have you on the show. I know that you are a regular listener, and I want to take advantage of that because I know you've been listening to my interviews with Jeff Snyder. Something Jeff has said that just really threw me for a loop when he said it recently is he said, you know, really, we have to just accept that U.S. Treasury bonds are not really an investment anymore. Big institutions need to have them as a balance sheet management tool, but they don't make any sense as an investment. And I thought about that after the fact. I thought, holy cow, what are all of the knock-on implications of the United States Treasury bond? You know, the full faith and backing of the United States government, cue the patriotic music, most safest, reliable investment on earth, and it's not even an investment in Jeff's eyes. How did we get here? What does Jeff mean by that? And what's the story of regulatory changes that have gotten us to this point?
Well, thanks for having me on, Eric. Look, Jeff's point is very well taken. I don't know what Congress and the Fed intended. Dodd-Frank was written right after the great financial crisis, and it may have come down to don't just sit there, regulate. But the rules are the rules, and the banks have had to buy $1 trillion in treasury since 2017 just to stay legally solvent. And now they're in the process of phasing in new margin rules for derivatives that are going to need another trillion to be bought and get posted. It's a giant financial transactions tax, really. And the markets are forced to deleverage and hold emergency liquidity in safe assets. And the regulators define safe assets as U.S. treasuries, which lowers borrowing costs. And who's going to complain about that? The problem, of course, as Jeff points out, is that treasuries are no longer really bonds then. They decouple from inflation and rates and even potentially credit quality. And the banks don't care what the real returns are. They just want to stay in business.
Okay, Ralph. So to summarize, before the great financial crisis, we had this whole banking system all levered up in these derivatives that didn't really have a lot of collateral behind them. Regulators step in and say, hey, guys, you want to play this game, you got to have collateral backing this. That forces financial institutions to need to have a whole bunch of safe assets, collateral on their balance sheets in order to continue to have the same derivative exposure they had before under the new rules. Now, I think that probably is going to answer one of the biggest questions that I had as I was reviewing your slide deck. Let's go ahead and jump into page 2 of the slide deck. Again, listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. Now, Ralph, this is a story that I've seen before, but at the time it had a very different ending. And what I'm talking about is 10 years ago, so many people were talking about, look, the U.S. government has this completely unsustainable borrowing habit, spending beyond its means. How is that made possible? It's because China keeps accumulating U.S. treasuries. Someday, China is going to stop accumulating more and more U.S. treasuries. In fact, what could be worse is they might even start to divest their existing holdings, and watch out, baby, that's going to cause an epic crash of the U.S. Treasury bond market. We're going to be unable to finance the U.S. government's borrowing. The sky is falling. The world's coming to an end. You know, that's it. Well, the crazy part, Ralph, is a lot of that story came true. China did stop accumulating treasuries, and it did divest a lot of its holdings. But not only did it not crash the bond market, but we've got all-time new lows in terms of treasury yields. Is that because of this phenomenon of the banks being forced to buy all these treasuries?
Right, exactly. And frankly, this chart is still the bear case. Who's going to buy all of the new issuance if the foreign official buying from China and Japan and et cetera can't keep up? And it ignores the regulatory bit. It's a perfectly fair question. But in a two-factor world, rates would be 10%. We're not in a two-factor world. We're in a world, again, where significant demand has been manufactured specifically by the regulations and by the rules that can only be satisfied with treasuries. And this is how you can have Chinese holdings fall and still have rates fall like they did last year. It's ironic, but the Treasury really isn't making enough new debt to go around.
Okay, Ralph, not enough to go around. That really makes me wonder how sustainable this is, how long it can last. When you say there's not enough to go around, is it going to stay that way? And what do we see here on page 3 where it says the Fed is back?
Well, what you see on page 3 is that the Fed is already back buying bonds and adding to the balance sheet at the fastest rate ever. Look, we saw a lot of back and forth in the financial press over why the Fed had to stop quantitative tightening and return to adding to the balance sheet. But the reason's actually pretty simple. The Basel rules made repo stupid expensive, particularly at quarter end. And it's important to remember that repo was never really a business anyway. It was something that dealers did for clients that bought a lot of bonds, the same way your car dealer would give you a loan if you bought a car. So now with the Basel rules, the dealers don't want to do it because it's going to tie up capital. And it's pretty obvious the Fed had no clue how fragile these markets were until the meltdown in September. So now to keep repo viable, what the table shows is that given the Basel arithmetic, the Fed is back in buying Treasury bills faster than the Treasury can issue them and trying to force feed enough reserve liquidity to dealers to restart the private markets. And page 4, our table here, shows what the supply and demand looks like for 2020 and 2021. It's back of the envelope, and there's a lot of moving parts, but it'll give you the general idea. And so we see that issuance for 2020 is $1.05 trillion. And that's a big number, no question. But what you see again is what the Fed's announced is that they're going to be buying bills for at least the first 4 or 5 months of the year at $60 billion a month. And that as they rebalance the portfolio away from mortgage-backed securities and reinvest the proceeds into coupons, they're going to be taking back coupons as well. So you start with $1 trillion in issuance, but by the time the Fed gets done taking back what they plan to take back, some of which, remember, is a consequence of the regulations, you're left with around $600 billion to go around.
Ralph, moving on to slide number 5, you're showing this very interesting and sudden change of direction, I guess, between government and prime money market funds. So first, what are we talking about here? What's the difference between government versus prime money market funds? And why is it that we're seeing this huge growth in government and it really prime fell off a cliff going into the end of 2016 and has only slowly recovered since then?
So what slide 5 shows, Eric, is the regulatory impact on the money market fund industry of Basel and Dodd-Frank. In 2016, 2A7 reform mandated that if you're a money market fund and you want to have a fixed net asset value, you can only buy treasuries and agencies. Of course, they still have prime funds that can buy CDs and buy commercial paper, but you see significantly less demand for those post the Basel rules. And if you drill down into the prime funds, what you find is about half of their assets are treasuries and agencies as well. So the point here is that after the Fed gets done, there's $600 billion, give or take, available to the private markets. And what you're seeing in the money market funds, last year we saw $500 billion of fund inflows with the stock market up 25%. And so the demand for money market funds continues to grow. And now with the rule changes, they're only able to buy treasuries and agencies, which again is the manufacturer of demand on a regulatory basis for treasuries and agencies, which is going to result in lower borrowing costs.
Moving on to slide number 6, you're saying here that treasury and investment grade bond demand flows will remain solid. Talk us through this slide.
Sure. So this is a little bit like the money market fund slide. What it's showing is that as a consequence really of, this isn't so much regulation, it's just demographics. The baby boomer population is getting ready to retire. And so there's a demographic bid for stable income. And you're starting to see that play out in substantial institutional demand for investment grade corporate bond funds. And just like the prime money market funds, when you dig down into investment grade corporate bond funds, you realize about 40 or 50% of the holdings are treasuries and agencies. And as the tighter spreads get, and spreads are getting very, very tight, the tighter spreads get, the more viable or the more substitutable treasuries become for corporates. You just can't find enough investment-grade quality corporate paper, so you just buy treasuries and agencies. And again, this is just an example of the manufacturer of demand, the natural capital markets demand for safe assets that comes on top of what the banks are having to buy and what the derivative books are having to buy to stay solvent and to stay in business.
Moving on to slide number 7, how do German bunds play into this story?
Well, domestic demand for treasuries as safe assets is only part of the story. There's also significant international demand for treasuries, especially when, as we see on page 7, the supply of bunds in circulation, that is the supply of German debt that's available after the ECB gets done buying as much as they're going to buy under the capital keys, which is all they can find. And the same thing's true on slide 8, when you look at Bank of Japan buying of JGB issuance, is that there's a tremendous amount of foreign demand for treasury assets that's going to result as a consequence of the fact that institutional accounts in Japan and Germany and really everywhere can't find enough assets at home to buy. I saw an estimate from a Japanese dealer not too long ago that suggested that there's $800 billion worth of JGBs in Japanese insurance company portfolios that all have yields of 1 and 2% that were issued years ago that are maturing in the next 2 years. And those portfolios are looking at nothing to buy at home, a 0%.
Okay, Ralph, so all of this really is a result of the fact that a lot of foreign institutions, by mandate, they can either hold their own country's sovereign debt or they can hold U.S. treasuries as safe assets. So if all of their own country's debt has been bought up by the ECB and there's none left to go around, that's even more demand for U.S. treasuries. Let's move on to slide 9. You're showing this very obviously pronounced uptrend in the U.S. dollar funding gap. What exactly do we mean by the funding gap and why is it growing this way?
What this is showing you is the IMF actually measures how much demand there is from foreign institutions to borrow dollars so that they can pay for the treasuries that they need to portfolio because they can't find anything to buy at home. As of the end of 2018, the IMF tells us that that was $1.4 trillion, and this number is doubling every 4 years.
Ralph, moving on to slide 10, LCRs have been falling. For any of our listeners who are not familiar, what are LCRs and why are they falling?
Well, here's where we get to the direct impact of the Basel rules on bank appetite for treasuries. This is where you got the demand to buy $1 trillion in treasuries to stay legally solvent. LCR stands for liquidity coverage ratio. And it's a complicated calculation that banks have to do on their balance sheets to quantify the amount of money that could potentially run, the amount of wholesale financing that they have that could potentially run under stressed conditions. And the LCR is a ratio that forces them to hold a certain percentage of that money in assets that can be sold very, very quickly if necessary, of course, treasuries and agencies. And what you see in this chart is that since 2017, the average LCR across the four biggest banks, that is the cushion, the buffer that they're holding, is beginning to fall pretty sharply. It's down from 124% of the regulatory minimum to somewhere around 115%. Now, 15% is still a good cushion, but remember, the banks would be insolvent if they failed to be 100% in their LCRs. And so they can't take the chance. You reach a certain point where they have to start taking these buffers back up again, and that'll mean buying more treasuries.
Moving on to slide 11, you're showing the impact of Dodd-Frank on U.S. Treasury demand. Talk us through this chart.
Well, this is really a chart of what the primary dealers, which are, once again, the big four, the big banks, what the primary dealers are beginning to hold in terms of treasuries. Some of it is to satisfy their LCRs, and some of it is in anticipation of increased demand for all the reasons we've discussed above. But once again, what you see is that ever since the Basel rules were phased in, the primary dealer treasury holdings have gone up very, very significantly.
Ralph, so far we've talked about the implications of existing legislation that's already on the books and what it's done to dramatically increase demand on U.S. treasuries. I want to move on now to pending legislation, which hasn't taken effect yet, but which is proposed and may affect this. Talk us through what's going on page 12.
So what slide 12 shows, Eric, is that in addition to the LCRs, in addition to the net stable funding ratio and all of the various rules with respect to the banks, Basel also mandates that all uncleared derivatives have to have initial margin posted. There has to be a two-way exchange of initial margin on all uncleared derivatives.
Okay, Ralph, you say on all uncleared derivatives, you have to post margin. Now, that margin is not cash. Presumably, it has to be more safe assets. So do you have to have treasuries in order to meet this margin requirement?
Well, what you see is it gets very nuanced and very dense, but the cheapest to deliver security against your initial margin requirement turns out to be treasuries. There are some reasons why cash is difficult to post, because cash has no yield. It also, it's difficult to post cash and segregate it and have it be bankruptcy remote. So what you see in slide 13 is that of the regulatory initial margin that's already been posted, and as of last year, ISDA tells us for the top 20 biggest firms, which are currently the firms that are being captured by the rule, it's going to be expanded in September of this year to cover several hundred firms, including buy-side firms. But of the 20 firms that are currently captured by the rule, the scope of the rule, that the vast majority of the collateral that's getting posted is treasuries. And so this is manufacturing demand for treasuries. If you want to stay in your derivative trade, you're going to have to post initial margin, and the cheapest to deliver security is going to be treasuries. And so this manufactures considerable incremental demand, probably on the order of somewhere around another trillion. ISDA's estimating in their slide on page 12 that under the best case scenario, which would be all firms using the standard margins, all firms using internal models and a $50 million threshold, in other words, below $50 million, there's no requirement to exchange, that using the $50 million threshold and using the internal modeling, that the best case scenario is that $800 billion is going to have to be posted as margin.
And what do the pie charts on page 13 tell us?
Well, the pie charts show you that to date, the exchange of initial margin has been predominantly treasury securities.
Okay, hang on a second, Ralph, because I hear what you're saying when you make the point that it doesn't matter if there's no yield because what they need it for is safety. But wait a minute, that's true for all of these big institutional holders of treasuries who have to have collateral for their big fancy pants derivative positions. But what about the rest of the financial institution that used to rely on U.S. Treasury bonds as one of the single most important instruments in every portfolio? We used to, in the good old days, most pensions had a very large percentage of their holdings in treasuries because it was guaranteed completely safe and it returned 5 or 6%, which was more than double inflation, and it was a pretty darn good return for a large pension fund, which is really worried about servicing a basic obligation of cash flow, not trying to make a fortune like a hedge fund. We had the standard 60-40 portfolio of bonds and stocks. Everybody's being forced to reach for yield and they're into junk now. So it seems to me there's a lot of knock-on implications to treasuries no longer being suitable as investments.
Well, they're already substantially below the return hurdles that the insurance companies used to expect. And what you'll see is you'll see further reach for yield. You'll see further yield compression. This is going to enable much, much more risk on, because if interest rates are zero, then equity multiples are infinite. And what you'll see is you'll see companies issuing debt and buying back shares and leveraging up their balance sheet. And you'll see retail investors and many institutions with no choice. They have to take whatever's there. You already see it in the high yield markets, where spreads are at historic tights and have nowhere to go but lower. This is the business we've chosen.
So what are the implications in terms of systemic risk? I mean, we haven't had a significant downturn since 2009. What happens when we get a significant downturn and all of a sudden it's not straight line up for stocks and bonds at the same time, the way it's been for the last 10 years? It used to be everybody had a cushion because they had plenty of good old guaranteed reliable U.S. Treasury paper returning 5 or 6% in their portfolio. That's gone. Everybody that was forced to reach for yield is into junk now and other riskier assets. What does that mean in terms of what could happen in the next downturn?
Well, there's two different systemic risks here. The first one is the risk that's being built into collateral transformation trades, because these treasuries aren't being bought to satisfy these ratios, Eric. They're being borrowed. And what you've seen is a huge business develop around lending out treasuries, not against cash collateral, but against non-cash collateral. The International Securities Lending Association tells us that there's $1 trillion in securities out on loan. More than half of those securities are sovereign bonds. And more than half of those sovereign bonds have been lent against non-cash collateral. And the way that works is you're an insurance company and you need treasuries to satisfy your new initial margin rules for the unclear derivatives that you want to hold. And not having swaptions is just not an option. You're going to want to continue to hold derivatives. So you need treasuries to post. You don't have them. You're not in the business of having treasuries and having cash sitting around on your balance sheet earning nothing. So you need the treasuries. So you go to a custody bank and you say, I need to borrow treasuries to post for margin. I don't have any. And they say, what do you have? And you say, well, I've got triple B bonds. And what's happening now is you're beginning to see collateral transformation trades that allow for borrowing the treasuries and posting much, much lower quality assets as collateral. Now, you over-collateralize them. You don't get a dollar's worth of treasuries for a dollar's worth of triple B junk bonds. You have to over-collateralize. But the question is, are you getting the haircuts right? You begin to see as these numbers get bigger and bigger, how the potential for a 2008-style run happening all over again, only 10 times bigger this time, is getting baked into the system, where you have these trades that the Treasury owners want them back or need them back, and the custody banks are unable to reestablish the positions. So that's one kind of systemic risk. The other systemic risk, it seems to me, that you're going to have is we're going to get to the point where when the curve goes completely flat, the banks are going to surrender. They're not going to want to stay as big as they are because there's no carry. I mean, there's no reason to be big anymore. And so at a certain point after the curve goes flat, the banks begin to shrink. They start to buy back their own shares. They start to issue debt, buy back their own shares. But they don't need to hold as many treasuries because they're not as big. And as they begin to shrink, and as they're holding fewer and fewer treasuries, that's going to come right at the same time that rates are zero or rates are negative. And zero rates are enabling MMT. They're enabling, you're already seeing it in Germany, where even the Germans are having difficulty explaining why they're not borrowing money at negative rates to spend on social programs. And so what I like to say is that zero rates, MMT, QED. I mean, this is what you're going to get. This is what enables the fiscal monetization push that, you know, Congress never has problems spending money. They just fight over what they're going to spend it on. So you reach a point where the banks surrender, they shrink, and their demand for treasury shrinks with it at the same time that the government is ramping up to take advantage of the new lower rates. And at that point, interest rates and the dollar can become very highly unstable. You combine those two risks, and what you realize is that it's ironic, but the regulators had nothing but good intentions. The way they designed the regulation has made the systemic risk worse, not better.
Okay, Ralph, help me understand how and when that worse systemic risk comes into play. Because from everything you're saying here, it sounds like at least for the immediate foreseeable future, what happens is there's lots and lots of institutional demand for treasury paper globally, and that does, in fact, make it possible for the U.S. government to continue borrowing at very low or maybe soon even zero interest rates, and they'll probably borrow a whole lot and spend a whole lot. When does the monkey wrench get thrown into the works, and what is the proximal catalyst that causes that monkey wrench to gum up the works?
So it's a great question. So In 2006, Ben Bernanke very famously said that no central bank need countenance deflation. They have something called a printing press. And he was half right. The problem with QE, the reason why it has not engendered inflation, is because, as they learned in Europe, it's actually limited. Even though the Fed has a printing press and they can print a lot of money, they're constrained by the available assets they can buy to create the reserves. Once you move to, once negative rates or zero rates or very low rates enables the MMT, enables the fiscal monetization, you're already seeing it in Europe. Christine Lagarde was hired to preside over precisely this, to convince the Germans to go ahead, if rates are negative, borrow the money and spend it. It's the only way to get inflation. So what you're going to see here is once Congress embraces the MMT idea, once they begin to increase deficit spending to simply take advantage of the fact that rates are negative, at that point, you're no longer limited by the amount of treasuries you can buy. Quantitative easing, the printing press can truly work because there's no limit. The Fed and the Treasury together can say to the markets, we're going to continue to do this. The Treasury will issue debt. The Fed will buy the debt, monetize the debt. They'll enable the fiscal monetization until we get the inflation we desire, until we can re-steepen the yield curve. And that's the point at which the system can become, from the point of view of being long duration at that point, the system can become very, very unstable. I think the Fed's convinced itself that they can probably control this, that they can dial it up and down based on how much they want to monetize and how much new treasury issuance there is. And they're probably right. What they can't control, it seems to me, is the risk, again, of collateral transformation, because it's the way the market is satisfying these new rules that's so scary. It's they're renting the treasuries, they're not buying them. And the collateral they're putting up in order to rent them is significantly lower quality collateral. And this is where the systemic risk event happens that doesn't just steepen the yield curve, doesn't just create a sell-off in bonds that, you know, maybe they start a fire they can't control. Maybe rates start to go higher and it feeds on itself. But I suspect they've convinced themselves they can just back off on MMT and back off on printing and control that. The question is, the collateral transformation trades that are getting set up to enable institutions to meet these new Dodd-Frank requirements, that's where the real systemic risk is. And it's a replay. It's a repeat of the systemic risk we saw in 2008. Where, look, there's a lot of different opinions about what went wrong in 2008, but what was happening was you were creating synthetic safety, you were structuring up subprime loans to create AAA securities that were supposed to be as good as treasuries, and those were being rented to the money markets. And they were being rented to the money markets with assumptions about haircuts that proved to be wrong. As we all know, very few subprime loans actually failed, actually lost money. No AAAs ever lost money. The problem wasn't in the cash markets that you had, that prices in AAA at mortgage-backed securities and asset backs collapsed. The problem was in the repo markets that they'd gotten the haircuts wrong. They had been giving 50 turns of leverage, a 2% haircut on the AAAs coming off of these mortgage backs, and the bonds went par 90. And then the problem wasn't in the cash markets. The problem was in the funding markets. The problem was in the repo markets. And when you think about what's happening now in collateral transformation, it's exactly the same trade. It's exactly the same systemic risk, only much, much larger, because the same assumptions have to be made about what haircut I'm going to give you on the BBB bonds that you're going to post to me. And it's all feeding on itself because rates are so low. There's no return on treasuries. So you have a lot of passive holders of treasuries who hold them in spite of the fact that they don't have yield precisely because they can lend them out. They can lend them out. And what you see is the more aggressive they're willing to be in the collateral that they'll take when they lend them out, that is the riskier collateral they're willing to take, the more they get paid. And so the more funds they attract, they're offering a higher yield to retail investors. They end up taking in more money. It's a it's an unnatural selection. It's adverse selection in the markets.
Ralph, I want to come back to something you said a minute ago about when we get to the inflation that we desire. And this resonates so strongly for me because something I've said for years is the end game here is when we get to the inflation that we don't desire. In other words, when that starts to run away from us. Because from what you're describing, if there's this massive demand for treasuries and the way we supply that demand is a whole bunch more government borrowing and spending and more indebted, then we get to the point where when you start to have an inflation problem, you can't increase interest rates in order to fight inflation because doing so would cause a fiscal crisis for the U.S. government. Some people think we're already there. So it seems to me like the big trigger event is at some point, if money is free and you're giving it away or you're giving or governments are borrowing it for free and spending it like crazy, eventually you get an inflation problem. And as that inflation starts to run away, you can't fight it with lower interest rates. Is that the mechanism that eventually causes this house of cards to all come falling down?
It certainly is a mechanism. Again, I think the regulators may have convinced themselves, the Fed may have convinced themselves that the solution to the debt problem now is the same solution that they had after the Second World War, when we had much more debt actually than we have now as a consequence, obviously, of fighting and winning the war. And the way the Fed fixed the problem was through financial repression. They had 25 years where inflation was higher than the interest rate on treasuries. And if you can create that scenario and keep it in place long enough, the debt takes care of itself. The debt literally disappears. And this is part of the reason that they're so desperate to create inflation. They're always obsessed about inflation's below target, inflation's below target.
Okay, Ralph, so it seems to me that the key to all of this is if they can stop inflation from running away, if we don't get into a runaway inflation problem, then as you say, you just keep inflation above the treasury yield for 20 or 30 years, and it will inflate away through that process of financial repression. The debt effectively goes away. That is known to work. So it seems to me the most important question to answer then is, what are the conditions that can lead to a runaway inflation that you can't fight? And remember, you don't have interest rates in your bag of tricks to keep it under control because you can't really increase interest rates very much at all under these circumstances without bankrupting the federal government in the process.
So that's a great question. And I think the answer has to do with whether or not alternative currencies become viable. As long as the dollar, as long as the government has a monopoly on the medium of exchange, the store of value, and the unit of account, that is the U.S. dollar. As long as there isn't an alternative to U.S. dollars, they don't really run the risk. They can just dial up and down the borrowing and dial up and down the Fed purchases. And in their own minds, at least, they can keep financial repression in place and keep the curves behaved. That all breaks down if there is an alternative, if Bitcoin, if gold, if transacting using some other kind of currency becomes possible. And this is where this is very interesting, where you also have, you can also look at stocks as an alternative kind of currency. There's no reason why you couldn't go into Walmart and buy everything you want to buy and simply transfer shares of your Fidelity S&P 500 account and pay for everything you want to buy in those shares and never go to dollars at all. And so the degree to which equities collectively could become an alternative currency is something the government has to keep an eye on.
Well, Ralph, I can't resist but to plug my own book here because I published a book in 2018 predicting the black swan the U.S. government doesn't see coming is the U.S. dollar is going to lose its reserve currency status to a digital currency, probably a central bank issued digital currency from a consortium of other nations around the world. That's as much of a shameless plug as I want to spend time on in this interview, but let's come back to where else this might go in terms of if we don't see a runaway inflation situation. You know, we tried quantitative tightening once. Bernanke told us that they were going to be able to unwind all of this extra liquidity that's been created through quantitative easing. What happens to the bloated balance sheet of the Fed for the next 30 years in that 30-year financial repression scenario that you described, where they inflate the debt away that way? Do they just keep the Fed's balance sheet where it is?
Well, the good news really here is that for the Fed, it doesn't matter where the balance sheet is, because as long as they have the Basel rules in place, they don't need a balance sheet to control rates. The banks do it for them. The banks are buying treasuries. The Fed doesn't have to. The bad news is what it means is they can't really exit. They can shrink their balance sheet, but they can't really tighten rates, not as long as the Basel rules remain in place. And what this means is that essentially they've lost control of the yield curve itself. And this is very important because eventually what you see is the flat curve destroys financial lending incentives. The banks are the ones that suffer when the curve goes flat and when the Fed is unable, as you see now, what I'm trying to tell you is that it looks like the Fed is unable to keep short rates down, given the repo issues. The Fed cuts the targets and the dealer banks, as a consequence of Basel, just say, if you want money lent there, you lend it. We're not going to do it. We can't do it. Not under the rules you're making us live by. And those very same rules create a situation where the belly of the curve, the middle of the curve, the 7-10 year range of the curve, they can't keep rates up. Once again, as a consequence of the financial regulation, there's so much demand for treasuries. And to stay legally solvent, the financial agents like banks and derivative books are being forced to buy them or borrow them, which creates the demand anyway. And you end up in a situation where the curve inverts. And what this does is it destroys your banking system. The Europeans are already dealing with this. This is the first fallout from QE. And without banks, without a healthy financial system, you can't really have the kind of recovery, you can't really have the kind of growth that's consistent with ever getting back to normal, ever getting back to a world where the Fed doesn't have to buy bonds and the government doesn't have to spend, isn't confronted by negative rates and isn't forced to spend money to try to force rates positive again. You also end up in a world where non-banks begin to take market share from the banks, because the non-banks are much less invested in the actual shape of the yield curve. You end up with an awful lot of financial transactions happening outside the regulatory umbrella. And of course, we already saw this again in 2008. The problem in 2008 was the ingression of non-bank financials. The banks were simply enabling the non-banks, but it was the non-banks that were creating the asset-backed securities, that were pooling the subprime loans, that were creating the AAAs. And again, they can do it without having to pay FDIC insurance, without having to have tellers, without having to have ATMs, without being regulated at all. The non-bank financials, the banks can't compete anyway. If you're going to make the curve perfectly flat, then they're really in trouble. Because over time, what the Fed has done is allow the non-banks to come in and take market share. And this is a problem they're also going to have to deal with. And you know, I've often thought that what the Fed's doing here is actually creating a situation where Basel may have been designed to hold the banks back, to keep the banks from making loans in the last 10% of the economic cycle. And that the Fed knew that by doing that, they would allow the non-banks to jump in and grab market share at the end of the economic cycle. And that when the credit bubble finally burst, when the market finally turned, that most of the damage would actually be confined to the non-bank financials, which was fine for the Fed. That's what they wanted. As Biggie Small said, somebody's got to die. And JP Morgan is too big to fail. Non-bank financials are not too big to fail. I won't name names. They're not too big to fail. And so systemically, the Fed may have been trying to arrange things such that the non-banks ended up with the market share at the end of the cycle and so much of the damage. The question is, look, the Fed knows if they raise rates, they're going to blow a $2 trillion hole in the world. The question is, can you do that without taking us back to another systemic event that's going to require you to blow yet another bubble? And I think what may have been in the back of their mind, since they discovered too late anyway, that they really didn't want the non-banks to have this much market share. Because if you wait long enough, there won't be any banks left. The banks simply can't compete with the non-banks, again, different cost structure, different regulatory. So the Fed may have arranged things such that the non-banks end up taking the vast majority of the damage, taking the vast majority of the hit when the credit cycle finally ends and when rates rise. And that's just the best way the Fed can play a bad hand.
Ralph, let's translate this now for the traders in the audience to investment market implications that people can actually use to influence their trading decisions. Obviously, the biggest and most obvious implication here is your outlook is for lower treasury yields over time. What else can we take away from this in terms of trading signals?
Right. So you want to own duration, clearly. You want to avoid mortgage prepayment risk. You want to probably avoid financials, because the flattener is going to mean that they underperform. And I think you want to try to stay with fortress balance sheets that have been the best performers anyway, the companies that can take advantage of the fact that they're going to be able to follow the Fed, follow the rates down in the belly of the curve, follow the Fed down to zero, issue new debt at zero, and buy back their shares. And so that's the big companies that have fortress balance sheets that can take advantage of the fact that rates are going to continue to fall. I would avoid financials.
And finally, before I let you go, Ralph, tell us what you do at Pavilion Global Markets.
So I'm part of a 4-person macro team, and we write a daily note. We're unconstrained. We write on international, on domestic. We write on regulation. We write on really anything that we think is investable and interesting. Pavilion's based in Montreal, and we provide institutional investors with that research. We also do global agency only equity trading, and we do transition management, which is helping institutions restructure and reallocate their portfolios when they change managers. And so institutional investors that are looking to receive our research or find out about our other businesses should give us an email, send us an email at strategy@paviliongm.com, and that's Pavilion with one L.
Ralph, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. We look forward to getting you back on the program for an update at some point in the future. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, what a great interview with Ralph. It was great to get a fresh perspective on the fixed income markets.
Oh, I agree. And Ralph is a super guy, and I really like, you know, he's a big picture thinker, which is what we try to favor here on Macro Voices. But Patrick, we have gotten overwhelmed in the last week, more listener feedback than we've ever gotten on any other topic, asking you, Patrick, to take your options knowledge and experience, translate what we got from Chris Cole last week in terms of the long vol component of a Dragon portfolio. Talk about how somebody who's running their own money in their own account probably can't be quite as sophisticated as Chris Cole is without using over-the-counter derivatives and so forth. But suppose you're just using listed options. Is it possible to replicate, at least in concept, that long vol component, and how would you do it?
Well, Eric, first of all, our listeners can find the chart book to follow us along. I've created a whole bunch of slides that help explain some of the different strategies, and you can find that in your research roundup email or using the download link on the homepage of the website. So the first thing that I wanted to point out is that Chris Cole really highlighted two very different approaches to how to be long volatility. He was talking about the traditional long volatility strategies versus being long tail risk positions. And I thought that those are two very distinct topics that should be broken up into two separate post games. So what I want to focus on in this part one is just going long volatility itself. And we'll save that long tail risk positioning for next week. And so the first thing that I really want to highlight is the fact that he really was emphasizing the idea that you want to be long, not for a rainy day, but long volatility to make money. money during a rainy decade. And the one thing about being long volatility through vehicles such as the volatility index, you really at that moment are looking for these spikes, these one day kind of shoot up in volatility that you can profit from. But it's those tail risks that that actually are the ones where you can really profit from a bigger trend emerging. And so one of the things that Chris was saying was that there was no silver bullet solution to this. He admitted openly that the key there is that you had to be a very dynamic and active manager when managing volatility. And this is so true because to me, Eric, there is no real passive way to actually go long volatility without there being that very heavy carry.
Okay, Patrick, and we can see this in slide 3. Now, you've got the VIX in black, and the VXX ETF is in the amber color or orange color here. Please explain this, because I think a lot of retail investors particularly, they think, okay, VXX, that's the ETF that you use to buy the VIX index, so they should be the same. These don't look the same. What's going on?
Right. So when you're thinking of different asset classes, the first thing a retail investor might think is, well, that means I'll just allocate 20% of my portfolio to something like an ETF like the VXX, and I'm going to be long volatility, and I can just forget about it, and I have it paired with my long portfolio. The problem is that the way that the volatility index is constructed and the nature of the VIX futures, right? So VIX futures represent this like linear forward on the future levels of 1 month variance in the market. And so you have this scenario that future volatility is trading in contango, which is when you buy the VXX, that contango is being rolled out. And therefore, you have this carry bleed. And so what we can see on this chart is somebody who says, I want to be long the VIX, perceives that the VIX has been flat all year. But someone who purchased the VXX and used it as a buy and hold vehicle over the course of the year is down 55% from that bleed.
Now, Patrick, I think this is super important because what it's teaching you in a very visual and a very, very compelling way is if you try to just use a passive investment product like the VXX ETF in order to gain access to volatility, even with the VIX flat, you lost 55%, more than half of your money. So it seems pretty darn clear that using a passive instrument like VXX, it makes sense for a few days if you're hedging some event risk, but it's crazy to think that you would hold VXX as a strategic component in your portfolio for the long term because it's got this decay in it. So if you can't do that and you do want to do something, what's the answer? Is there a way using active management that you can get the effect of the black line instead of the orange line here?
Right. So this is where I wanted to really split up the conversation into two separate segments. One that we're going to cover this week, and next week we're going to cover a lot of the tail risk ways of going long the market. So that's where you could try to find a minimal cost of carry, and you have that high convexity of the gamma on the wings. And then we're going to talk about some different ways that you can really put on those longer dated positions to kind of build a hedge in the portfolio for those big tail moves that Chris described as the wings of the hawk, that fiat devaluation risk or the disinflationary impulse left tail that could come in the markets. But we'll talk about that next week. So this week, what I wanted to cover is the traditional ways that options traders approach just getting long volatility. And so I wanted to just spend a little bit of time on page 4, just going through some of the terminology we use in the options market for measuring volatility. And the option Greek we use is called vega, which is the measure of an option sensitivity to the changes in implied volatility. And so as 1 point change of implied volatility occurs, it's changing at the rate of vega. And so on this slide, what I have is an example where we have a $2.50 option and that has a vega of 20 cents. and its starting implied volatility is 10%. And so as the implied, with all other variables being constant, so we have no time decay, we have no delta moves or price changes, all we have is an immediate change in the implied volatility going from 10% to 11%, which is a 1% change. That 1% change changes the options price by that rate of vega. So that option that was originally priced at $2.50 and had, with a 20 cent vega, with all other variables being constant, is now worth $2.70. Now, this works both ways. When volatility, let's say, goes from 10% down to 9%, then you saw that option go from $2.50 to $2.30. And so it's the rate of the sensitivity of a particular option to those changes of implied volatility.
Patrick, on page 5, you've got moguls on a ski slope on the top, and you've got the inverse on the bottom. What's going on here?
All right. Well, really, what I wanted to illustrate was the nature of volatility, which is that it's not reverse when you're long a call versus long a put. In fact, you're long vega or long volatility when you own options. Whether it's a call or a put, you actually have a positive vega. To the reciprocal, the seller of the options, those that are short options, have the negative vega. So in this way, whether you're long a call or long a put, as volatility expands, both the call and put will actually increase in value. And at the same time, the options will decrease in value as volatility contracts. And so by that nature, when you are selling premium, you want higher volatilities and you want to see volatility contraction while you're short the option. And to the reciprocal, you want to be long options when volatility is about to expand. And so to illustrate this, therefore, the one strategy that is considered to be price neutral but yet long volatility, therefore, is a very traditional straddle, which we have on page 6. And so if you're both long a call and a put, you are actually neutral about the price change because one of the options is going to build an intrinsic value if the price moves. But you are now long double the amount of vega because you have the vega on the call and the put. And so when traders are just trying to bet on a short-term immediate increase in implieds, often expressing that with a long straddle is a way for them to immediately profit from changes of volatility. So when you hear, there's an entire group of options traders that just trade vol, right? That's their game. And they're trying to identify where these different cycles are and trying to profit from the changes of these prices on a day in, day out basis. To illustrate this on page 7, what we did here was we priced out a $100 stock with a $100 at the money strike, 30-day options priced at a 25% vol. And so the theoretical price in the simulator is that the call option is $2.85 and the put is also $2.85 for a net $5.70 value of a theoretical price of the straddle. And so we wanted to ask, and they're both obviously long vega, and so we wanted to just see what kind of a return would someone long a straddle gain from a change in the volatility. So what I did here was decayed one day of time. So we say you own the straddle and you held it from today till tomorrow, so one day of time decay, but the implied volatility over that one day rose from 25% up to 30%, so 5 vega points. And what we can identify is that those options now had a material rise where the straddle is now worth $6.74, a full $1.04 profit. And again, the key here is that there was no change in the stock price and the amount of time decay was just one day. And so that almost 18% return that you gained on the increase in the value of the straddle was purely a vega move. It was purely an increase in volatility that created that profit. And so when traders are looking at getting long volatility, going into a straddle is one of the ways that they can express that.
Okay, Patrick, you've explained how to use an option straddle where you buy both a call and a put option on the same underlying issue at the same time in order to gain access to volatility right now. What if we want to have volatility as a component of the Dragon portfolio? So we want to have it not just for one trade, but on an ongoing basis. How do you carry that out?
Well, that's where we want to go back to that interview with Chris, where he was talking about the long straddle having carried positively over the greater part of 70 years and identified that it had a positive performance through the Great Depression, as well as a positive performance through the 1970s. And so what is it that Chris Cole's talking about? He clearly isn't putting on a straddle on a short-term bet that volatility will have a quick spike on the overnight session. He's building the straddle as a component that is accompanying the portfolio. So you might, let's say, have a 20% allocation to the S&P 500, and then you might have a certain percentage allocated to S&P straddles that is accompanying that. Now, the most obvious thing that you can see from this chart is the fact that if you carry this straddle to its maturity and the price remains unchanged, there is a huge theta burn, which is the time decay. You're long both a call and a put, and if there's no change in price, you're paying double the premium and watching it time decay to zero. It seems, definitely in a flat market, that is for certain a losing strategy. But this idea of rolling the straddle throughout this period is something that Chris is talking about. And this comes back down to the point that he was saying that he has to be a dynamic and active manager, which is this idea that you need to be able to roll and move that straddle as you're going. So I don't know exactly how Chris did it, but clearly to back test it, he had to have a systematic approach for which way he was managing the straddle through that period. So a way that I could envision that being that you, let's say, are always long a 6 to 9 month straddle, and in the final 3 months of the straddle, whether it's built a positive return or not, you close it and open a new one that's 6 or 9 months out, and you just keep rolling it forward. So one of the interesting things that I'm showing on this chart on page 8 is the fact that your maximum loss only actually occurs at expiration. So as time decay is occurring and the market remains unchanged, the U-shape in that payoff profile starts to gravitate lower. But the key to this idea of rolling the straddle is this idea that the market is not going to stay the same. And as soon as you have any meaningful move higher or lower, you're building some form of an intrinsic value. And because the straddle is not in the portfolio to make money during those very short moves, what you're doing is you're trying to buy that tail, right? Which is that if there's an extraordinary move higher or lower, then the straddle starts to enhance the portfolio in whichever direction it is moving.
Okay, Patrick, what we've seen in this post-game segment is how to use an option straddle, which is just one of several different techniques that I know you teach in your options class. But this is, as you said, specifically focused on carrying that vol exposure, not on tail risks, but on the market in general. What can we expect on our next part two when we do the post-game segment next week?
Right. So next week, the key is to look at a second Greek, which is gamma. So when people hear the word volatility, they immediately assume that you're talking about therefore trading vega, which is going long volatility itself. But when we're talking about that allegory of the hawk, what you're talking about is these huge tail risks on both the right and the left of happening. And really, that's the idea. How do you buy or put on some form of an option strategy where if the markets were to have one of these extraordinary moves on either side, how do you create a position that builds huge gamma on one of these big tail moves? And so that in itself is a whole different strategy, and I'm looking forward to talking about it next week.
Okay, Patrick, we'll look forward to that in the post-game segment after next week's podcast, but I can feel it coming already just based on the volume of responses that we got about doing this today. I know that there's going to be more interest beyond that. We can't really take it much farther than this, folks, on the podcast, but I want to pitch an idea to you, Patrick. I think you should take the whole idea of the long vol component of the Dragon portfolio, and you should make a whole series or a whole class or something for your big picture trading members. Any interest in that?
Listen, I'll look forward to getting the feedback from our listeners if there would be an interest in that. But I certainly think it would be an interesting idea to put together a boot camp, because it's great to talk about the theory. But the one thing is that when you go into the live markets and you see the different vol skews and the way that the market is setting up, it's about how do you put the right options together to build some of these compelling strategies. So it's definitely something that we should think about. And I'll announce something next week.
Well, Patrick, I think you're going to get plenty of interest, because it feels to me like this is one where you really need to see all of the mechanics of putting the trades on and so forth. But we'll see what the listeners come back with. Meanwhile, folks, if you want, you can get a free complimentary 2-week access pass to see everything Patrick does at BigPictureTrading.com. Just go to BigPictureTrading.com and sign up for the free trial. We're going to have to leave it there, folks. This episode was made possible by TopTradersUnplugged.com. Remember to get the ultimate guide to the best investing books ever written at toptradersunplugged.com/macro guide. For information on sponsoring Macro Voices, please visit macrovoices.com/sponsor info. Listeners, be sure to register a free account at macrovoices.com. The benefit to you is you'll receive our Research Roundup email, which provides you with all of the best free content that we could find on the internet each week, including downloads associated with our guest appearances, as well as, of course, our post-game chart books. Patrick, tell them what they missed in this week's Research Roundup.
This week, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book for Ralph's presentation, as well as the long vol slides we discussed here in the postgame. There's also an interesting article from Nouriel Roubini about white swans of 2020, and an article discussing a call from JP Morgan's Marko Kolanovic that this time is not different. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend, and myself at Patrick Ceresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the Internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.